for those on audio, this is the Foundation for Faith and Science to ask, why did God create, and what is his plan for the seventh day? To help answer that, I would like to look at the classical question that has troubled us for a long time with some good answers over the centuries. Why would a personal, loving, all-powerful God allow evil and suffering? I'm going to suggest that the answer to this question has a very important element, time. And to show that time, I would like to follow God's actions from creation through the New Testament using the second parable of eight, the wheat and tares as they're separated, and look into where separation ends at the last chapters of the book if we want a peek, to two places, heaven and hell, forever. My name is Steve Huffy. I am actually in real estate, and over the years I have bought buildings, fixed them up, rented the residential out, and kept them. Southern California, that's worked okay. I've studied Hebrew and had a presentation recently with the Bible Archaeology Society, Los Angeles chapter, on recent archaeological finds, and I'd say recent, past 25 years, of proto-Sinaitic Hebrew that affects our understanding of especially Genesis, but throughout the Bible, as we'll see today a little bit, and also presented at the ASA Winter Conference for 2 years at Azusa Pacific University about Darwin and using Hebrew to follow evolution through chapters 1 and 2. Also talking a little bit using the model of Dr. Gerald Schroeder with science in chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis. As we consider creation, I would like to end up this talk with an application that we can walk out the door, and that is, how can we separate goodness and evil? And I'm going to suggest God's model is forgiveness. He came to earth to forgive, and he said to the thief on the cross, your sins are forgiven, and God, he mentioned, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And if we have time, I'd like to look a little bit at goodness in the context of forgiveness as application. To start with, there's three papers, and I brought three papers mainly because, did this shut off? Okay.
Yeah, I went through your lecture already.
It's actually supposed to be rolling in the back as I talk, so hopefully it seems like it's not going to, it's supposed to be on a loop. And we'll use two of the papers during the lecture. One is the Foundation for Faith and Science paper. That will be the notes. Another would be more specific on bara, to create. And the third, which is a heavyweight with a lot of detail, is for you to take home and peruse in any section that you might find interesting. In thinking about the theme of separation of goodness and evil, recently the first verb in the Bible, has been looked at for quite a while, but the exegesis was questioned, and here on this paper I've tried to put it the best I could without having scholarship take our time. And as I do this, I'd like to put the sometimes called proto-Sinaitic Hebrew or early Hebrew, sometimes called Phoenician, which looks like it comes from hieroglyphs, and it was used at the time of Moses, so it becomes very interesting to us in that it's pictographic, much like Chinese pictures. It's taken from nature, and it tells, being taken from nature, it's usually action words, and tells us a lot about Genesis and really throughout the Bible. For instance, to give you an example, the up in the upper right-hand corner of bara is our three symbols. Being Hebrew, the third symbol from the right is an ox head, meaning mighty power, leadership. That all became the Hebrew Aleph, and it also became the Greek Alpha, which became our letter A. Can you see the letter A? Just twist, give that a rotation, and you have A. The second one, Resh, is that of a head, and it has the R sound. In Greek, that became more looking like a P, but it was R sound. And as you can see from my profile, we have an R. It became the Latin R, English R. In fact, our English is so much more like Proto-Semitic that Moses was writing in, because the modern Hebrew block script came through Nabataean influence and changed quite a bit from the Proto-Semitic. The remaining symbol is the second letter, Bet, and it is a nomadic tent. And you can see the entry with the little division there. It's looking down on top, a floor plan of a nomadic tent. It became the Greek Beta, which became our B. So the Albet became the Alpha Beta, which became the alphabet. And it's almost like going back and walking with Moses. Coming down to give a background on creation, Barah has been looked at in lexicons with three definitions, which have been unusual and caused conflict. A lot of ink spilled over a lot of paper. In those lexicons, usually they will have created as definition one. They will have definition two as cut, usually for the intensive or called PL form in Hebrew. And then they'll have it to do with fat, or to take a fattened part, referring to, I think, Second Samuel, when the priests were taking the fat and gorging themselves of the best choices of the meat. And that's always been uncomfortable. So I'm going to use those as examples to show better continuity with the word bara as separated, and then apply that to goodness and evil. In that context, it would be nice to know some other verbs that are used in Genesis 1. Haya is a generic, but an important one. It let there be light, and when God is speaking in Exodus and said unto Moses, I am that I am, it was that verb used twice. Asah is the most prevalent verb used in Genesis 1, and it is much like taking a material that's pre-existing into a factory, manufacturing, and coming out something else. Yatsar, which is not used in the first creation account and only used for the first time in the second creation account, looks over a period of time. And that's probably from the second creation account on the transition. It looks back into the first creation account, transitions, looks back, and then gives more detail in the second account to creation day 6. Yatsar is much used for a potter, molding things, or a baby in the womb over time, and such things. Let's turn the page, and I'm going to skip around just a little bit. At the top of page 3, we have a verse from Isaiah that's usually caused a lot of contention. It says, I form the light, create darkness, and I make peace, and I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. And there's been several answers how God creates evil. Here with bara as separated, it makes more sense. I form the light, yatsar, over time, and bara, separate the darkness from it. I asah, manufacture peace, if you will, and bara, separate evil. So the separation process becomes more clear, and I, the law, Lord, asah, make all these things. The Ezekiel passage right below becomes so interesting. It is a military maneuver. Thou son of man, appoint thee two ways that the sword of the king of Babylon may come both twain and shall come forth out of one land, and choose, bara, thou a place, and choose it at the head of the way to the city. It's more than just choose. It's to separate it. The military maneuver there was to to forge ahead, and at the head, choose a place that you think would be a good head for your battle. And you choose it because you want to use it as a base of operations for the next secondary show of force. And so this is separate you a place and separate it at the head. Now it's interesting that Barras has the concept of not only separating, but separating a space. And we'll see that in its intensive form using Joshua 17:15 on page 3. There, he said, I'm going to cut into it halfway through. Get thee up to the wood and cut down for thyself there in the land of the Perizzites and the giants and so forth. This is to cut a grove of trees. Oftentimes the king of Tyre would provide trees for a temple for trade and so forth. This has always been really a good, well used, in that cut is the intensive form of to separate, cut. And it's to separate a space. That is just a little bit of the background of starting of creation, to separate. I'd like to go through some words here about creation. The word waters, and I want to set up a paradigm, if you will, a framework of creation so we can understand separate is not just one word. Maim, or waters, here from right to left, in Proto-Semitic is an ocean wave and an arm and a hand, an ocean wave again for the sound. The ocean wave was the great unknown to mariners. And it shows up in words that are unknown about unknowns, interrogatives, like ma. Here's ma. This is a man with his hand raised. It shows up in me. Who is it? But in ma'im, it's unusual in that usually the masculine plural is im, but when it's a'im, it's a dual form masculine plural, which means that there's only two of it. So we normally read waters in the Bible when we know... normally say water, but not waters. So Mayim in the Bible is only two, and it starts to make sense that there's water above, water below. They're separated first to heaven, heavens above, which is Shah, one letter onto Mayim, and that, I don't have time for that, but, and then that is called, and anything called is considered completed to the extent that it is functioning. And usually that functioning thing is a support for the next level of creation. After that is called the earth from the waters below. So we know in science today that earth came from the heavens. We're probably a third generation supernovas. The supernovas make iron and carbon and higher elements that allow rocky planets and life to operate. Without them, we would not be here. So the Bible follows that pretty well, and we follow the Bible pretty well. Other words that you'll see on your back to your note paper, if you would be words badal, which is to separate, ben, and they just keep coming about separation. In your paper, let's turn to pages page 2 at the bottom. There's a wonderful historical verse there in 1 Peter, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and spot, who verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in these last times before you. When somebody told me about this verse and interpreted it, it amazed me that here, if I had an atheist ask me, why does he would set up a syllogism like this, he said, we can assume that God is good, thus he would desire to get rid of evil. And then if we assume that God is omnipotent, that he would get rid of all evil with that desire. We see evil, thus we can assume that God is not omnipotent and good. Well, I would up the ante to him. I would say, here we have a verse that God knew beforehand, before Adam and Eve sinned in his omniscience, that he would... he would separate, is that 4 minutes?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. That he would separate, that he himself would die, and I would immediately have an attention. I'd up the ante, if you would, a little bit. And so the process through here is that God, in his omniscience, had a problem. A third of the angels fell. And the question is, what is he going to do about it? And he separated the days and gave them higher order one day after another. That separation process is actually a gathering in an order process leading to mankind, which I think, made in his image, we are created for his purpose. And his purpose is seen for us in the wheat and tares, where they are intertwined at the roots and inseparable. But the answer to the person who says, what do? Is to produce fruiting bodies, wheat heads and tare heads. Now, normally parables don't make good doctrine because they're not well explained at the end. But this one, Jesus answered, and he said, the wheat heads are those which are preserved, they're your works. The tare heads are also your works, and they're burned. And those with wheat will be bright and shining as the sun and preserved. If we think of Revelation, there's a wedding going on, a fashion show, if you will. A white linen is being worn by a lady which is white purity. And it says after that, that linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Well, some Bibles will say righteousness of the saints or righteous works of the saints. So this theme of works and separation continues through. And I think I'm going to stop right there because I like a lot of Q&A. Usually people become one super brain, we get good questions. Any questions? If not, I'll continue. How many more minutes, do?
Yep.
Or with Q&A, how much?
7.
Okay, well, question.
Pulled up Genesis 1 on my iPad. So I don't know the Hebrew on this, but verses 26 and 27, and then let us make mankind in our own image, but also God created mankind in his own image, the image of God. He created them, male and female, he created them. Now, what was instances of
How many did you count? There's three of them there that are...
Yeah, in verse 27.
Yeah. It's actually it's interesting. Body, soul, and spirit in Orthodox Judaism, at least, comes from the three events of bara. There's five baras in the creation, in first chapter, six if you stop the creation at chapter 2, verse 3. The first bara to do with the material world. It shows up in verse 1, that makes us. The second is in day 5, when the oceans are swarming, which many people have identified with the Cambrian explosion. It fits really well on a timeline there. It's interesting that bara there, which is identified with pretty much supernatural intervention, and that's a good question, when is intervention by God, has the first use of the word nefesh, soul. I find it interesting that those animals and all the phylum of animals that we've ever had, many of them now extinct, were first phylum with notochords and central nervous systems. That's what really made a lot of animals, plus motility, defined an animal. The third events of bara are seen with mankind, used three times there. And a good reference verse for that, to understand that bara more, is actually the review of it in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, where there's... the neshama, the spirit that is breathed into mankind. Now, I'm sort of going from Orthodox Judaism here. Many will say that third bara is the higher central nervous system that is able to communicate and understand and reach out to God and God to them. Great. Does that help? Sure.
Fit that separation notion in that God created man in his own image.
Let me bring separation and the idea of reconciliation, if I can use that idea. Yeah. Reconciliation is to conciliate, to make friendly, again, to reconciliate. So as God separates goodness from evil, he is reconciliating mankind. And the question comes, if even without First Peter foreordained, if God is omniscient, why would he go ahead and create us who get hurt, and why would he go ahead and create himself? in the form of human to take on our hurt and redeem us? And the answer is, if we're made in the image of God, we need to know the purpose of God. And his purpose is to separate goodness from evil forever, to have a temple, if you want to take that view of Genesis and the end, a place to live. And in fact, in Ephesians, it says the Spirit of God is our marker. Now he lives in us. And in the New Jerusalem, it was John who was asked by the angel, would you like to see the bride? Well, that's us, because in Ephesians chapter 5, Paul is telling about husband and wife relationships. And he said, all of a sudden, he says, whoa, stop. I show you a mystery. I'm talking about Christ and the church. And then he goes on, nevertheless. So we as a bride here clothed in the righteous works of our wheat, if you will, that we bring forward, has an ultimate separation as agents of God. That's a really good concept to think of reconciliation, is that we're doing the purpose and will of God. And it's a way to love God. How do we love God? Well, we give him the best goodness that he desires. And his desire is a separation, which comes back to us. If we love him, that's a pretty good deal. He loves us on that. So hopefully that puts the separation and the reconciliation of bringing back a more purified goodness forever on that. Yes?
One issue I see when you were bringing up the theodicy arguments that an atheist or agnostic might raise against God is that I think if you bring up Adam and Eve after that, they're going to just, and the fall, then God bringing Christ to renew that, they're not going to accept that as literal.
Because sort of stretch that out a little
They're going to say Adam and Eve is myth.
Yeah. So what do we do if Adam and Eve were not in the Bible? Shall we call it a John Walton Temple situation or what? I would say until that's well proven, to leave them there. And let me suggest,
I'm just saying in general, if they're brought and introduced to an atheist, the atheist won't accept that.
And you'll see this in the paper. And the reason I suggest to leave them there, because it brings us into the two trees of good and knowledge of good and evil and that of goodness. I have a section in the paper you'll take home. Can't see the forest because of two trees. They've always been in contentions in some ways. This is my suggestion to the atheist on what those two trees mean. And we can pick them up in Ezekiel 47, where the tree of life again appears in that eschatology section of Ezekiel after chapter 40, where the leaves are for the healing of nations. And they parallel a lot Revelation 21, where again the tree shows up on both sides of the crystal river flowing from the temple of God as the source. And they are again for the healing of nations, where the nations come in and out of a gate to access them. Well, think back, and what my question would be, it's always challenged me a little bit, what if Adam and Eve ate of the tree of life first and then ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Would it have dried up and died or whatever? And I'm saying based upon Ezekiel and Revelation, where there's a continual taking and the bearing of the fruits, in every fruit 12 months, different fruits, that the tree of life is not a one-bite tree. But the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is a one-bite tree, so that if if it happened that Adam and Eve would have partaken of that tree first and they'd eaten of the knowledge of good and evil as they did, saying, believe in the devil, you know, God is not on your side, you're maybe more smart than God, and doubting a good God, then at that time they would have experienced the same situation that they did, and that is to cut off access from the tree of life. It would have been the same deal, so that they would not live from then on in their sin. But God in his omniscience knew, and we've got to get this clear, that in verse 31 of chapter 1, where it says his creation is very good, we oftentimes think perfect. But if we think about the garden, which follows there, it was not a very good place necessarily. Satan slithered in the garden. There was a battle ready to go on. And it's interesting that a helpmeet in Hebrew is a zer, which is a military term, very close to a czar. You'll find it in your paper, but when David says, God is my help and my shield, that help there is the military context of a shield, Azir. And Azir is really, in throughout the Bible, is another army formation of another nation that is complementary to the first army with their own set of skills that they bring together to take an objective that alone they could not take. So that is the context that the early readers would have understood Azir as a helpmeet, and they would have understood that they had a job to do with God. Does that help a little bit? That's sort of a big answer for all of that. Yes?
In your title, part of your title is Hearing His Plan on the Seventh Day.
Thank you, and I didn't have time, and if you're willing to stay behind, that's key, I'll answer it for you, but I'll have to give a chance to move on for those who do.
We have 2 or 3 minutes, but we don't have a speaker
after
this
that.
As well.
Okay.
Yeah. Steve, what do you think of C. John?
Thank you for that key question first, because I sort of cut that off thinking I'd have lack of time. The seventh day does not end in the evening and morning, where all the other 6 days do in Genesis. And it's good to know our early Hebrew in this case. It'll shine brightly. In fact, you can go to Strong's Concordance, and if you click down on the primary root of Strong's, and I put Strong's numbers in on this bra so you can follow those numbers on verses, you'll find good roots for the primeval, if you will, Genesis of prime words. And for evening and morning, in that sequence, it becomes the Jewish day, it becomes the representation of creation, because Erev, which is easy to remember in that Hebrew, it's Erev evening, E-R-E-V, it's almost like evening. It means, it's the time when the sun goes down, and the primal roots means an intermixing or dissolution or a lack of order. And so that made sense for people. When the sun went down, you couldn't see so well and things became intermixed. Boker, just the opposite, which comes next, and I remember that as morning has broken. Boker, broken. And sun breaks forth, and things become more orderly. And that's how they understood that, and based on their vision. Now, evening and morning in that sequence on each creation, days 1 through 6, mean that there is a system within each day that where one level of disorder was taken to the next higher level of order, day by day. And we can follow that pretty clearly, that within systems. So the seventh day, it doesn't have an ending. And it's thought that we are in the seventh day. So when God rested, and I struggle with that translation, I like cease much better. He ceased from creation. He didn't rest for refreshment, as some people claim. He didn't rest and start snoring. But he ceased from creation in order to work the plan for which all things were made. And think of it, we're the apex on sixth day of the plan, made in his image. And if I'm going to know anything about his image, I have to know about his purpose, you see, why this creation is here, and then join him in his purpose. So the seventh day is to work the plan. And I hope that answers that. Yes?
John Collins, in Genesis 1-4, the commentary, also argues that the seventh day continues to the present moment.
Yes.
And he has an analogical view of God's work week is set up as an analogy with our work week, and that not everything in the sequence is necessarily for chronological reasons. Sometimes they're gathered for thematic reasons, kind of like in the Gospels. You compare the Gospels, sometimes the order of events is for thematic or logical reasons. Do you think that's what do you think of that, his basic thesis about the analogical?
I'd love to talk with him sometime, and maybe I'll get a chance to do that. I think Genesis, because of the words again, show progression, and a couple good reasons. Why are there so many ands in Genesis? Does anybody know why all those and gods, and this, and oh, we need to cover that then. It's a consecutive. We have one type of and. It's a conjunctive and. You can take an and just mark it. In fact, in ancient Hebrew, the and in modern Hebrew, it's a vav, and it's connected to, as a prefix to words. In ancient Hebrew, and I may not write this, my memory's not pulling up, but it's more like a tent peg. In fact, it is a tent peg for a Bedouin tent. If it's camping, we just put it in, and it's connected. There's two types of ands. One is like our English and, the other that just you can put whatever in, and the other is called a consecutive and. And things cannot be jumbled up, but they actually, it's a Hebrew way of storytelling that connects the story in progression, and when it stops, you know the story of progression is over. And sometimes it's called the consecutive vav that is put on there. Now, it's as bright as day for somebody who knows what they're looking for, because a consecutive vav is only attached to a verb, and it does something really unusual. It reverses the aspect, or sometimes we call the tense, of that verb. For instance, when it says, and God said, or in Hebrew it actually be and said God, so there's a verb and the and attached. It's really in the past aspect, and in the future aspect, and all those are in the future. But the consecutive vav put on there, everybody sees it written in the future, and they read it in the past. So, and it'd be just the opposite for a past would be future. So it's really a big deal that they do this to say, this is a progressive story that comes through. Now we get the and from Genesis 1:3 all the way through 2:3, except for one verse in there. Verse 30, I think, is a list of things that we are able to eat and whatever and do. And so there's a noun with an and we know when it's to a noun, it's a conjunctive. Okay. That is one really convincing thing, that this storyline has progression and connection.
And he agrees with that to an extent. He says this is it identifies the genre as exalted prose narrative, and you've got main storyline tense, which you just described,
right.
But then you have the prologue, which indicates the prior event setting up, you know, before the focus is on Earth.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's got an interesting argument. I just thought
I would add that.
Read it and interacted with him on it already.
I have, and I'd love to. And here's the other thing to add to it that I'd like to interact with him on,
yeah,
or somebody else on, is that the words in Genesis, like Mayim, the waters come first,
yeah,
but they also show up later on in the heavens, which are the Shah Mayim.
Yeah.
To a Jewish person and to the reader of Genesis, any root that shows up in a later word has the characteristic of that root, as most languages do, and it developed from that root. It has connections, so that the waters came first, the Shamayim shows this progression on them. And there's some other things in there too that are really cool. You mentioned the prologue. Just want to touch that a little bit. And because it's an area of controversy that's probably good to know. And sometimes the most closely looked at things are controversial because we raise more questions. But Hebrew stories start out with a summary of what will be told in the story. It's almost like reading a story to a child once upon a time, and you sort of set it up, and then you tell the story. And there in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, there are no consecutive vavs. And when it says...
The first two verses.
Excuse me,
yeah.
Of Genesis 1 and 2. And it starts with the verse 3 as a consecutive vav. There's something that's really interesting happening. Verse 1, there's a merism. Some people call it hendades, but it's not. It's a merism, which is a Greek word meaning two parts of the whole. And the merism is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's almost like I looked high and low means I looked everywhere, okay? This is a really, if you want to understand Hebrew and want to learn Hebrew, start with this letter about map. It means look, breath, reveal. And see, this is a neat thing about pictographs. They have usually three definitions because they're found in words that do those things. And so each letter has almost as much information as three words. And when you get them in a root, you almost have a sentence of information before you've even got out of the word. And it's really cool because they're on nature. And so look, breath, reveal is the letter hey. and it turned into epsilon in Greek. Can you see the E? They just the Greeks just rotated stuff, okay? Okay. And that's R E, okay. And so he's saying, look, he's holding something in his hand. I want to reveal this to you. And the reason that's important, Hebrew is very person-centered. It's an action language. It's concrete. Well, how do you get action out of concrete that you have on a floor someplace? Concrete means it's based in reality, in concrete reality, and that reality to them was action. If I had a pen, I could have a Hebrew word for pen, but the most likely way they would say it, a Western person would say this, this is black and translucent in parts, 6 inches long. The Hebrew person would say, this is the thing that I write with. They're into action. That's the difference. The Western world is, well, the Hebrew world is fairly noun poor, but very verb rich. And that makes it great for Genesis because there's action. There's these different verbs for types of action. And then the Western world tends to be more noun rich and verb poor. So if you go to Israel and you see a puddle and you see the Sea of Galilee, they use the same word for it. they don't have a lot of nouns. So in the Bible, in learning Hebrew, the biggest saying is context is king for nouns. And that's why for evening and morning, for day, to define what a day is really important. It's a section of time that takes from disorder to the next level of order, and it combines with other words. Did that sort of help a little bit? Yeah, on that. In your paper, you'll find some sections on goodness. And if you're interested, if you're not off to someplace else, I think this is important. If I can go ahead a little bit and talk about it.
Time is up, but we don't have another speaker after that.
Okay. So. I think you'll like this. In goodness, let's see. In goodness, for humans, right makes might. And we can discuss about right. And oftentimes, we don't say might makes right because we get in trouble, mighty things, in mighty ways. But when we come to an omnipotent God, Paul in Romans 9 is saying difficult things about, let's look at that. It'll be in your sheet on page 5. And in Romans 9, the children not having been born yet, and I'm going to paraphrase, God says, Jacob I've loved, but Esau I've hated, or not loved so much. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness in God? What's our free will and choice here? Will you say to me, doth he find fault who hath resisted his will? And Paul's answer is, O man, who are you to reply against God? Shall the thing formed say to it that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? I'm going to posit that Paul is arguing here that the ultimate right is with the ultimate might. That whoever the biggest personality in the universe is, God names what is right. And we don't have much to say with it. We're very fortunate to one thing with his might, and it determines what's right for us, and we need to know his purpose and the separation of goodness and evil and why we're here. That his might, one of his greatest portions of might is his mercy towards us, his forgiveness. He came here with the work of forgiveness on the cross for us. When we got hurt, when he made us as his agents to separate goodness and evil to two places, heaven and hell, wheat and tares, he just didn't say, well, good enough for them, I'm going to throw them in the trash, they're through. No, he loves us, and he wants to redeem us and have a new wife. He knew we would be hurt. He knew that there was a battle. And so in that goodness, we need to recognize that has a purpose of separation, but he does it in a way that loves us and that is merciful. In the back of that sheet, I sort of got had some fun. I took an orange juice crate and I bottled mercy. And on the back of that sheet, you can read later a little bit, how does mercy work when you drink it? And how many ounces should you take and so forth? In that mercy towards us, he forgave us. And if there's one thing I hope we can take out of this is what is forgiveness? And we all have a pretty good concept, I think. But as you know, I like words. And so I tried to find out the origin of that word forgiveness for us, and it's Old English. And there's relationship word give. There's the relationship words of give and take. And forgiveness and forgetting is much like give and take. We have forgive and forget, or like take. But the four in Old English means not to give. And if we think about that, what does God not give us? Well, Lamentations 3:22 says, it is of the Lord's mercies, in that category word, that you are not consumed. He doesn't want to consume us, but that's what would happen. And then 3:23, great is thy faithfulness, new morning by morning. When we forgive somebody, I can have irritation, even bitterness with people. I'm asked to not give that. The trick about forgiveness, if we look at Christ, and we just look at ourselves, is that he not only did not give us what we deserved, but then he gave us, in replacement, truth for life. As I forgive somebody, I am challenged to say, what do they need to be given to lift them? And I really have to look in myself and take that mote out of my eye and say, can I find a little bit? And I have. I look in myself and there it is. And as I work on that, that's a maturing process. And then I know how to give them goodness. And I think that's how God wants it, in that he wants to give us goodness, his goodness. That's a lot of his image in practicing that mercy. And forgetting is interesting in that in Old English, a cognate word is to remember. That means to member, again, like taking iron or something and building and putting members together and you construct it again. But on forget, it's that we don't get anymore. And that really talks about change and maturing and sanctification. God forgives us, but he wants us to change, right? And he doesn't want to keep getting the same old stuff. He looks for change. So as he forgives us. In fact, if we don't change, we've not accepted his forgiveness. And people, if we change, they don't keep getting the same old stuff. So the question is, well, if I forgive somebody, do I have to be a doormat? No. There is a reciprocal back and forth. Give and take, forgive and forget. It is a maturing process there. And that's some application I think we can take out with how to separate goodness from evil, our challenge of being like Christ to forgive and then give truth for life. Thank you for your consideration.